Welcome to episode 44 in the fourth season of Justice with John Carpe, the podcast from the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms. I'm the show's producer, Kevin Steele, and with me is our host, John Carpe, the president and founder of the center. So here we are at the end of 2023 with our look back at the year that was, the successes, the failures, the laughter, the tears. What went right? What went wrong? Year-end reviews are the thing in the last week of December's. So by golly, we're going to do our best to face up to our responsibility and meet your expectations. After all, we may sound like mavericks, questioning mainstream narratives, challenging government diktats, but believe me, deep down, I, for my part, like to fit in with the crowd just like everybody else. So let's take the deep dive and dig deep down and really get at this year in reviewing. To begin, John, I want to ask you a specific question on a singular topic. Tell me, what do you think of 2023?
Well, I'm going to start off on a sad and negative note. So brace yourself, and you're going to feel very miserable and depressed by the time I'm 20 minutes into the podcast.
Yay.
But we're going to end on a high note, justifiably so. And I will start by talking about a lower court ruling in Ontario, Hillier versus Ontario. A horrible decision came down in November. We have appealed it. We filed the papers, and we're taking that to the Ontario Court of Appeal. So Randy Hillier is a former member of provincial parliament. He was with the Progressive Conservative Party, and then I don't know if he got kicked out or left or a bit of both, and he was an independent, and now he's no longer in elected office. And he got tickets because in 2021, the Ontario government imposed, among other things, a total ban on all outdoor gatherings. So this means, like, even if you have five people that are 6 feet apart, like, just no outdoor gatherings, period, right? Right. So Randy Hillier probably thought, and I have not discussed this case with him, but he probably thought, well, you know, surely the government cannot win on the science here. I mean, you've got people, it's even illegal to have people outdoors 6 feet apart at a peaceful protest. This was also quite a strike at one of the fundamental charter freedoms in Section 2, which is Section 2C, which is the freedom of peaceful assembly. The other ones are freedom of association is 2D, and freedom of expression is 2B, and then freedom of conscience and religion, 2A, is the very first freedom in the Charter, is conscience and religion. So this is a serious threat to democracy when the government says you cannot peacefully protest outdoors. It goes to the heart of one of the fundamental Charter freedoms. And I guess implicitly the freedom of association, freedom of expression is also violated by this. And security of the person, and there's a whole bunch of violations, but this one in particular, the peaceful assembly. So Randy Hillier joined rallies and spoke at rallies and got tickets, and then in court, one of your defenses to, if you get a ticket, whether it's like a ticket for a provincial offense or also if it's a criminal charge, your defense can be to say, yes, I did that. I was outdoors with other people on, you know, Tuesday, May the 5th, you know, at 2 p.m. at this location. Yes, I did that. And my defense is that the law itself under which I'm being issued this ticket is constitutionally invalid. So that was his defense. Now, this decision, many of the court cases that we've run, we have had medical experts, we've had doctors, we've had former chief public health officers of Manitoba and Ontario that have been witnesses. This one, because it was a little bit further along in time, our expert was Dr. Kevin Bardosh, who is a Canadian who teaches at Washington State University in Seattle, has a doctorate from the University of Edinburgh. He is a medical anthropologist. And medical anthropology is the study of social, cultural, economic, and political factors that affect public health. And his report is very lengthy. It has hundreds of footnotes, and it really spells out what any reasonable and intelligent person could have just seen with their own eyes and known about, but not have the data to back it up. Namely, lockdowns cause a lot of harm to a lot of people. We knew that in March of 2020. You know, I'm going to reference, I won't mention her name, but a very good friend of mine has a 19-year-old son who has mental health issues. I don't know if it's schizophrenia or something else. And so he was doing really well. He had a job. He had a social network. He had friends. He had a girlfriend. And then lockdowns get brought down. He gets terminated from his employment because of lockdowns and loses his job, loses his support network because it's illegal to get together with other people. And, you know, you can't play sports. You can't get together with other guys and play pool, et cetera. And next thing you know, he's back out on the streets. And he's been in awful shape, and it breaks his mother's heart. And so we don't, you know, common sense, we don't really need the expert reports. However, in courts, you do need them because, you know, judges should not pay too much attention to anecdotal evidence, which I would argue is a good reason not to not to listen to the government's claims, because there's a lot of anecdotal stuff in there. You know, lockdown saved lives. I have yet to see persuasive evidence to actually prove that point. But it's anecdotal. You know, we kind of figure that, you know, if we destroy all the small businesses and force everybody to go into Walmart, that that's going to save lives. And if we shut down churches, we just kind of believe that it's going to save lives. There's no persuasive evidence. Anyway, judges should not be looking at the anecdotal. So Dr. Bardosh's report relies on 150 peer-reviewed Canadian studies representing hundreds of Canadian scholars, and he's using data collected in 2020 and 2021. So this is a report that we couldn't have produced in 2020 when the Justice Center first started suing governments over lockdowns. So he goes through this is on our website, by the way, the Bardosh report. If you go to www.jccf.ca, and if you look for Hillier, and you'll see Hillier versus Ontario, and then the Bardosh report, you can find it. You can read it. It's depressing reading, but it's all backed up by peer-reviewed studies and government data. So he goes through, for example, that he cites all the evidence that proves what we kind of knew already in 2020, but now he's got all the data to back it up, that the lockdowns caused deteriorating mental health, including a rise in anxiety, panic, depression, emotional disturbances, loneliness, insomnia, worsened sleep quality, suicidal thoughts, deliberate self-harm, social conflict, and higher consumption of alcohol and cannabis. He has all the data to back that up. It's like I said, there's hundreds of footnotes to all of these other studies. In similar fashion, part of the mental health, there's a decline in life satisfaction, decline in optimism, decline in community belonging. And the other scary thing is that increases in mental health deterioration and chronic disease take many years to manifest. So the worst may yet be to come. And you hear some talk about this anecdotally about the kids that, you know, missed so much school and they're behind on their math and their reading. And some of the younger kids are behind on their ability to speak, because if everybody's wearing a mask, as a child, you don't learn how to speak. So Justice Callahan, he says nothing about any of these problems. He acknowledges that the report was adduced into evidence. He says, without any explanation whatsoever, he says that Dr. Kevin Bardosh is not a public health expert, which I just have to wonder, is a public health expert, is that somebody who cares only about COVID and no other dimensions of human health? I don't know. It's just ridiculous to say he's not a public health expert. He's more of a public health expert than some of these chief medical officers that are they're focused only on COVID. They don't care about anything else. How can you say you care about public health when you only care about one thing, and then in taking these fanatical extreme measures to combat that one thing, you inflict a whole bunch of harm on other people in other ways? So the report gets ignored. Justice Callahan does not reference anything in the report and says that Dr. Kevin Bardosh is not a public health expert, and no reason or rationale provided for that assertion. The report also goes through medical literature pre-2020 showing that in-person contact is necessary for mental health and physical health. So long before lockdowns, there's abundant medical literature showing that we as human beings, we have a real need to connect in person with other people. Phone and Zoom and technology are not an adequate substitute for that. Another example of what Dr. Bardosz touches upon in his academic report is the mental health damage and the emotional harm of people being prevented from going to the funerals of loved ones. I've been told the average funeral attendance is 250. Maybe that's incorrect. Maybe it's only 100. Maybe it's only 50. But when the health authorities say that only 5 or only 10 people can go to a funeral, you're necessarily excluding 40 or 100 or 240 people who would like to attend, because we need that as human beings. We need to grieve. We need to gather with other people. We need ritual. And so it's very damaging. And when you consider 300,000 people die in Canada every year, approximately. So 300,000 people per year, if you think of all the lockdowns, you're looking at millions of Canadians that could not go to the funeral of a loved one. He also talks about the mental health disorders and disabilities, homeless people, those at risk of domestic violence or addiction, low-income families, minority groups, First Nations, immigrant communities. These were the hardest hit by the lockdowns. He produces the data to show that lockdowns created a generational paradox. The elderly and already sick people who were threatened by COVID were less likely to be severely affected by these restrictions. And then in contrast, the 90% of the people who are not threatened by COVID, who are the younger and healthier people, they're the ones who suffered the most from lockdowns. They also exacerbated the gender employment gap for women. And one of the reports noted that prisoners were subjected to torturous conditions that were psychologically harmful. So physical spaces that vulnerable people depend on were closed, social support networks were disrupted, and the lack of face-to-face contact meant that social workers and families lost touch with vulnerable people. You also have inadequate health care. Pre-2020, it was a sacrilege. It was a mortal sin for a doctor to diagnose over the phone or even by Zoom. It's like, no, you have to come in person. And there's good reasons for that, because in person you might notice, especially if it's a patient that's been a patient of yours for a long time, you know the patient well. It's like, oh, well, your skin's a little bit yellowish. You know, what's going on? You can ask some questions. You can't do that by phone. And all of a sudden medicine gets switched to telephone medicine, which is inferior. And I think everybody acknowledges that's inferior. The doctor should be seeing people in person. And then we have all the economic unemployment, thousands of small businesses destroyed because politicians arbitrarily deemed them to be non-essential. So many small businesses were destroyed, but the exact same products were being sold by Walmart and Superstore. And that's where people were massively congregating, you know, like, wouldn't it have made more sense to have the people spread out a bit more to a whole bunch of different stores? Oh, no, we all have to go to Walmart, you know? So and this is life savings for some people. Not everybody has a cushy public sector job with a generous pension or a decent pension. There's a lot of people, they invest in their small business. And what they're hoping for is that when they're, you know, 55 or 60, 65, 70, whenever they want to retire, they're going to sell that business for $1 million or $2 million, and that's their retirement. And they have no other pension. So when the politicians and the health authorities destroy your small business, it's not just your livelihood, but for some people, that's their life savings and their pension, completely destroyed. And so that gets ignored. Justice Callahan ignores the data showing that lockdowns killed more people than COVID. For example, in British Columbia, from March to September 2020, 465 excess drug overdose deaths compared to 258 COVID deaths in the same period. So 465 excess, meaning 465 more people than what were ordinarily previously dying of drug overdoses. 465 excess drug overdose deaths and 258 COVID deaths in the same period in British Columbia, ignored. The court ignores the suffering of the elderly who were subjected to what, if we did this to prisoners, it would be, you know, denounced as horrific torture. the isolation, solitary confinement. There were seniors that they couldn't see their loved ones. The loved ones could not see the seniors, and they're just confined to a room. And of course, because the politicians are frightening everybody into a state of fear, you have lower staffing levels in the nursing homes because they're staying home because they're terrified of COVID, even though they don't need to be, because most of those staff are younger and healthier people. All of this just gets completely ignored. There's not a single sentence in the court ruling that is devoted to any of the lockdown harms, nor does the judge explain why he believes that a total ban on all outdoor protests is somehow saving a lot of lives. Doesn't even go there. What's the problem? Why didn't he go there? Well, he is citing another judgment. This one goes back to February 2022. This was Justice Renee Pomerantz of the Ontario Superior Court of Justice ruling against in favor of Ontario and against Trinity Bible Chapel. And she ditches 36 years of jurisprudence. We have what is called the Oaks test. This is a 1986 Supreme Court of Canada ruling that says that interprets the Charter. The Charter says that in Section 1, the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms guarantees the rights and freedoms set out in it, subject only to such reasonable limits prescribed by law as can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. I hope I'm quoting that correctly because I'm not reading it. And so basically what that means is that governments can violate our constitutional freedoms. However, the onus is on the government to show that, among other things, that the violation is doing more good than harm. So, for example, we've got the hate speech provisions in the criminal code. They were challenged as being unconstitutional. And the Supreme Court of Canada, in a close ruling, I don't know if it's 5-4 or 4-3, one or the other. Sometimes they're down a judge or two, and so it's a panel of seven judges. So in a narrow ruling, the court was unanimous. All seven judges said, yes, the criminal code prohibition on the willful promotion of hatred against an identifiable group on the basis of that group's race, gender, religion, etc., it does violate freedom of expression, which I think that, obviously you got 7-0 on that point. It's pretty obvious that, it does violate your freedom to willfully promote hate against an identifiable group. But it was upheld. And when you read, it's a very thoughtful judgment, whether you agree with the dissent or with the majority, they're very thoughtful judgments. And they go through, the court goes through and looks at the benefits and the harms and weighs them. And the majority felt that the violation of the freedom of expression by the criminal code prohibition on hate speech, that does more good than harm. And also that law was narrowly tailored. So for example, there's a bunch of defenses for an accused person that the statement that he made is true, or that it was based on a sincere religious conviction or the interpretation of a religious text, etc. So we have the Oaks test from 1986. Up until the last two or three years, the courts held the government to account to demonstrably justify with persuasive evidence that the violation of a charter right or freedom was doing more good than harm. Well, this went out the window with Justice Renee Pomerantz in Trinity Bible Chapel. I'm going to read a passage from paragraph 6 of that ruling. Quote, various affidavits were filed on this hearing, including evidence from medical experts. These experts disagree on several points, including the extent to which COVID-19 posed an unprecedented threat to public health, the extent to which the virus can be transmitted outdoors, and the extent to which religious gatherings pose a greater risk of transmission than retail settings. My role is not that of an armchair epidemiologist. I am neither equipped nor inclined to resolve scientific debates and controversy surrounding COVID-19. The question before me is not whether certain experts are right or wrong. The question is whether it was open to Ontario to act as it did, and whether there was scientific support for the precautionary measures that were taken. End of quote. Now, she just completely contradicts herself. First, she says she's neither equipped nor inclined to resolve scientific debates and controversy surrounding COVID-19. But then she goes on to rule in favor of the Ontario government's violations of charter freedoms. So she effectively does resolve the scientific debates and controversy in favor of Ontario, while having declared that she is not equipped to do so. So that's a big contradiction, right? I'm not equipped to do it, but I'm going to rule in favor of Ontario. Now, in her written judgment, she does not take a hard or serious look at the competing evidence. I mean, she describes it in part, references it, talks about it a bit, but she doesn't do an actual analysis as to why she believes that the government's expert witnesses and expert reports and evidence are more persuasive than the evidence that was put forward by Trinity Bible Chapel and the other people that were fighting their COVID tickets. She doesn't explain which side is stronger, but she just goes on to rule in favor of Ontario violating charter freedoms because she feels that the government has put forward some undefined and unknown quantity of, quote, scientific support, unquote. So again, there's a contradiction. She says she is not equipped. I'm neither equipped nor inclined to resolve scientific debates and controversy surrounding COVID-19, end of quote. But then she says Ontario has some scientific support, very vague, undefined, ill-defined. Therefore, I'm ruling in favor of Ontario. So this is pretty scary because it means that governments in Canada, federal, provincial, municipal, and government bodies, government agencies, College of Physicians and Surgeons, Law Society, Teachers College, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, governments and government bodies can violate our rights and freedoms if they claim that there is an emergency, and then they can point to some unknown quantity of scientific support, and bingo, the government wins. So it's a new terrifying reality. Heads and the government wins, tails and the citizens lose.
Well, in this Hillier decision, I did notice that the Judge Callahan did give sort of some space to a Oakes test in the latter part of the judgment. You know, he went through each section, minimal impairment, rational connection, pressing a substantial objective, et cetera, et cetera. Reading through this, it looks like perhaps some clerk handed him a file gleaned from the pages of the Toronto Star to justify all of this. But still, it's there. You know, he does do the Oakes test. In the end, he really concludes that this was one of the biggest health crises of the last 100 years. The last sentence, restrictions were justified under Section 1 of the Charter. Just before that, he says, in the extraordinary circumstances existing in the spring of 2021, the gathering restrictions were both necessary and a proportionate response to the most significant health crisis of our time. As I think I commented to you a while back, you know, if this was that, you would think they might hold a public inquiry into their response to it.
Yeah.
Yet the government doesn't seem to think that this is serious enough to, you know, investigate what happened in order to learn what might be done in the event it happens again. So,
except for Alberta. I mean, we had Preston Manning and other prominent citizens, and we had a commission and an investigation, and we have a very thoughtful report of which Preston Manning is the primary author or lead author. And but other provinces, to my knowledge, have not looked back in time and done their homework, which is disgraceful. When you think about how much damage was caused by lockdowns, not only is it a constitutional imperative for governments to think about the harms of policies and not fixate on supposed benefits, but morally, how can you do this to people and then say, yeah, well, we're not going to take a hard look at what we did. We're just going to move on. We don't want to talk about it anymore.
It's my opinion that the reason they don't want to do that is because then judges wouldn't be able to make statements like this, you know, that this was the, most significant health crisis of our time. You know,
the other quote that you'll find in judgments, and this is just quoting from media, that, you know, this is the worst health crisis in a century. Well, the truth is we had the Asian flu of 1957 and the Hong Kong flu of 1968, and COVID was on par with both of those. So it's the third bad flu in a century. And of course, the other big one that COVID was compared to that got everybody really scared was the Spanish flu of 1918, which COVID in 2020 was, you know, 1% or 5%. It's just a tiny fraction of how bad the Spanish flu was. It's just no grounds for comparison. So, but you said that this judge applied the Oak test. He appears to, if you read through the ruling, he definitely talks about the Oak test, and he goes through the first component, which is that there's a pressing and substantive problem, which I would agree with up to a point. I mean, yes, but it wasn't the Spanish flu of 1918. And the death stats are showing that. I mean, if COVID was that bad, you'd see this huge leap between the 2019 death rates and the 2020 death rates. And you don't see that. And don't take my word for it. Go look at any government website. There wasn't this spike in deaths. The spike came in 2021. We won't get into that right now. So he appears to go through, so he goes through the first component and says pressing and substantive concern that the government needs to address. Okay, fine. You know, we could concede that up to a point. But then he just does a very cursory, he kind of glosses over each point. And for example, the first point is rational connection, meaning are these measures actually bringing out the results that they're supposed to bring out? Well, the government had no evidence before Justice Callahan that the lockdown measures were saving lives. They said it, and every newspaper and TV station and radio station said it hundreds of times a day. They said it. Persuasive evidence was not before the court that was true. So the rational connection, he doesn't go through the evidence and say, here is why I believe the government's evidence is more persuasive that there was a rational connection. He doesn't do the analysis. Second point, minimal impairment. A law that bans all outdoor protests, even 10 people standing 6 feet apart outdoors, and they get a lot closer when there's hundreds of them in the Walmart, but you know, 10 people standing 6 feet apart outside is illegal. That is just overly broad. That is not minimal impairment. And then on the last section, he does not go through the evidence. So he appears to apply the Oaks test, but in fact, he does not. Because if he was to apply the Oaks test, he would go through Kevin Bardosh's report and he would explain why the government has more persuasive evidence to show that the benefits of lockdowns are outweighing the harms of lockdowns. He doesn't do that.
Okay. So that was 2023 for us. Is that it? This one case? Yeah, no, it was a big one.
No, though. That was...
It did sort of encapsulate a lot of stuff, right? So,
well, I referenced two cases, right? So there's Justice Renee Pomerantz in a Trinity Bible Chapel case, and those very contradictory words that, again, she herself says, I am neither equipped nor inclined to resolve scientific debates and controversy surrounding COVID-19. One point I want to add to that, this judge and every other judge in Canada, they are always making rulings, often, not always, they're often making rulings on things in which they do not have expertise. For example, if a plaintiff patient sues a defendant doctor over medical malpractice, there are a few judges who were medical doctors before they became lawyers and then judges, but by and large, most judges are not medical doctors. And yet the judge will resolve the scientific debates and controversy because you can bet that the patient's going to have an expert witness saying, oh yeah, the doctor was negligent. And the doctor's going to have an expert witness there saying, no, the doctor was not negligent. And this judge, who is not a doctor, is going to make a ruling and say, yes, the doctor is liable, or no, the doctor is not liable. If a building collapses and the tenants who sue the owner, who sues the construction contractors, who sue the engineers, who sue the architects, and everybody's suing everybody, is it always going to go before a judge who is an architect or an engineer? No. You're going to have judges there. They're not architects. They're not engineers. They're not construction people. They don't know how buildings are built, and they're going to make a ruling about who is liable for the collapse of the building. So this is just outrageous and ridiculous and sad and horrible that you've got judges that are every day issuing rulings and they are resolving scientific debates and controversy. They do it all the time. And then along comes the government violating our charter rights and freedoms. And now we have a judge saying, I'm neither equipped nor inclined to resolve scientific debates and controversy surrounding COVID-19. Well, you won't see that that line in her other judgments. Mm-hmm. Now, sadly, this mentality or this principle has spread like a cancer, and so it was applied by courts in the case of Harji, Gateway, Baudouin, Ingram, Grendel, and it's a problem. But we were going to shift gears to the positive, but go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask, so what's the big lesson of 2023, taking into account those cases that you just referenced then? What's the big lesson? That judges should be equipped, or that, well, you tell me, what is the lesson from this year?
Houston, we have a problem.
Okay.
But so let me shift gears. So the obvious question then becomes, you know, why continue to litigate in the courts when you've got judges that are, you know, declaring themselves to be neither equipped nor inclined to resolve scientific debates and controversy? And why not give up and quit and throw in the towel? And so I'm going to mention four reasons why we need to keep on going.
This is the good news, right?
It's a transition to the good news.
Oh, okay. All right. We'll get there eventually.
This part will be short, the transition part. So why do we need to keep on fighting these battles? Well, first of all, we need to draw attention to this new problem. And if we don't keep on fighting in the courts, you got to be in the battle to fight. It's like a baseball game. And if team A does not show up for the game, team B wins by default. So we have to be in the courts to advocate for truth and for freedom. And we have to draw attention to this new problem that the Oakes test that judges were following and applying for 36 years from 1986 through to, you know, 2022. We have to keep on fighting these battles. The second reason to keep on litigating in the courts is that court actions force the government to reveal its weak hand when it has little or no science to support the violation of our charter rights and freedoms. So, for example, in our action on behalf of Brian Peckford and Maxime Bernier, government officials admitted under oath that there's no medical or scientific basis to bar unvaccinated Canadians from getting onto airplanes. We get that out into the public domain through a court action. You would never get that through a news conference. A news conference politician would when faced with it, tough question. And this would only happen if somebody like The Rebel or True North or Countersignal or Epoch Times or Western Standard got before the politician, because government funded media are not going to ask any tough questions. But if there was an independent media person there asking a tough question, the politician can just shut down a news conference. In contrast, when you're getting cross-examined by a lawyer in the Justice Center's network of lawyers, you can't just say, okay, well, thanks very much. That'll be all for today. We're done. No, 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 no. Lawyer will tell you when he or she is done asking you the questions. So that's the second reason. We have to force governments to show just how weak and pathetic their evidence is. And you cannot do that unless you're litigating in the courts. The third reason to keep on going is that the Justice Center's court actions pressure governments into abandoning charter violating policies when the government lacks the appetite or the confidence to fight. This is somewhat related to the first reason. In the Peckford case, for example, after we had these federal government officials admit under oath that there's no medical or scientific basis for the travel restrictions, the government dropped the policy. Another example, the ArriveCan app. The Justice Center was the first civil liberties group in Canada to sue the federal government over the ArriveCan app. This was mandatory use. For, you know, even if you were elderly and you didn't have a cell phone and you had hard copy paper documents about your vaccination status, you're still going to get slapped with, you know, $5,000 fine for not using the ArriveCan app. After we sued the federal government, they dropped the policy. Another example, a lot of people have forgotten this, but in 2020, the federal government stopped issuing passports, except for what the government deemed to be emergencies, but they were going down from, my rough calculation, if there's 40 million Canadians, 20 million of them have passports, 10 million expiring every 5 years, 10 million expiring every 10 years, blah, blah, blah. The math comes out to 200,000 passports issued every month. Maybe that's wrong. Maybe it's only 100,000. But we're going from 100,000 passports, or maybe 200,000 being issued every month, down to just a trickle if you were lucky enough to qualify for your emergency. You can't leave the country without a passport. The charter guarantees mobility rights, right? So this is a violation of mobility rights when the government says we're not issuing passports anymore, except for a tiny number of people that we think their emergency is sufficiently grave. So because there are people, you know, you want to visit a dying mother or father who lives in another country for work purposes, schooling purposes, etc. So we filed our court papers and sued the federal government over its refusal to issue passports. 4 days later, the federal government announces, "Oh, we're gonna start up again and issue passports again." I know they've done a terrible job of it, but it wasn't as bad as it was for those.
I'll say.
For those March, April, May, June, July, for all those months that the federal government was not issuing passports. And I'm proud of the Justice Center's lawyers for taking that on and getting that done. Fourth and final reason why we need to keep on litigating is that it exposes flaws in legislation. So, for example, we had the Ingram ruling, Ingram versus Alberta. That was to the best of my knowledge, that's the first challenge against lockdowns, or certainly one of the first in Canada. We filed that in December of 2020. We got a ruling in July of 2023, and only 2.5 years. And so the court, it was a mixed ruling. On the positive side, the court struck down all of the lockdown measures because they said that they were not purely issued by the chief medical officer, that they were actually the health orders of Premier Jason Kenney and the cabinet, and that was incorrect because they interpreted the Public Health Act as saying that Deena Hinshaw, the chief medical officer, has this unfettered unilateral power like a medieval monarch and can trample right on our charter rights and freedoms, and there should be no political interference in that, which I would say, okay, so you don't want democratic accountability. So they were struck down, which was good, although the court also said that there were no charter violations. And of course, the judge in Ingram, so Justice Barbara Romaine, she quoted, "I am neither equipped nor inclined to resolve scientific debates and controversy surrounding COVID-19. My role is not that of an armchair epidemiologist," end of quote. So,
Sounds familiar.
Sounds familiar. Yeah. So the good thing that came out of this is that the Alberta Justice Minister in November, so the Justice Center recommended to the Alberta government that the Public Health Act be amended so we have democratic accountability, which is consistent. It's a constitutional principle, democratic accountability, that the people make the laws and the people have indirect, I mean, it's our representatives. The representatives make the laws, but they're accountable to the people. And so when you have a law that says that, you know, your church is shut down and you can't go to church, or the total ban on outdoor protests, that there be citizens' input through elected representatives. That's a basic constitutional principle. So the Alberta Justice Minister introduced legislation in November to amend the Public Health Act to specify that there's going to be democratic accountability and the chief medical officer does not have these unfettered unilateral powers. So that effectively overturns the court ruling, which legislatures can do, and that's legitimate. So the next time there's fear-mongering and there's false claims about there being something equivalent to the Spanish flu of 1918, the chief medical officer in Alberta is not going to have the powers that Deena Hinshaw had over us for three or more years.
Can I just interject here that, by the way, was my highlight of 2023, was the Ingram decision, which came down and was a little bit confusing. But then after John made his recommendations and the Alberta government did the same, not saying they'd necessarily followed him completely, but that to me was the highlight of the year. And that's also why I love being Albertan. Just throw that in there.
All right. Me too. So now those are the reasons why we're going to keep on fighting. So I'm gonna end the podcast on key achievements in 2023, battles that we fought. We were in the trenches. So our team of lawyers and paralegals handled literally hundreds of court cases across Canada, all of them in defense of charter rights and freedoms. We've had some very good successes on securing acquittals of people who were unjustly facing criminal charges when all they did was peacefully exercise their charter freedoms of expression and association and peaceful assembly in Ottawa in early 2022, almost 2 years ago. And in other cases, the Crown withdrew the charges. Other cases with some of the provincial tickets for violating health orders, we've secured with the consent of clients, we've secured that they're going to pay, you know, $50 donation to a charity and they're not going to pay the $1,000 fine. So we've had a lot of success, and it's been good for the politicians and the powers that be to get the pushback on these things. With the help and the support of the legal team, our communication staff work tirelessly on educating Canadians about the free society. We've got our charter curriculum, and we've got the first module is out the door on freedom of expression. And in 2024, we're going to produce more modules on freedom of conscience and religion, freedom of association, freedom of peaceful assembly, and so on. We have had dozens, well over 100, I don't have the exact number in front of me, media interviews. We've had columns published in the National Post, Epoch Times, Human Events, Western Standard, other print and online publications across Canada. We went to bat for Nurse Amy Hamm in British Columbia, provided her with legal representation. She was disciplined. She faced 3 years worth of disciplinary proceedings because she publicly asserted that there are only two genders. And I'm proud of the fact that the Justice Center is willing to go to bat for people like Amy Hamm. You know, some groups, they don't want to have anything to do with somebody that gets accused of being transphobic or hateful or anything else. We don't care about the name calling. We're going to go to bat for freedom of expression. We've gone to bat for Leah McInnes, a nurse in Saskatchewan. She did not oppose the COVID vaccine. In fact, she said it was good and people should take it and it was beneficial. However, she said that it should not be mandatory. And for that, she faced disciplinary proceedings at the hands of the College of Registered Nurses of Saskatchewan. So we've gone to bat for her free speech rights. Constable Michael Briscoe, we're waiting on a decision. He was found guilty of discreditable conduct. Police officer with an exemplary record of service, no complaints, no disciplinary proceedings. He donated $50 to the Freedom Convoy, and for that was found guilty of discreditable conduct and fined 80 hours of work, 2 weeks of pay that he lost for having made a $50 donation as a private citizen to Freedom Convoy. We're going to bat for his privacy rights and freedom of association, freedom of expression.
That one was based on an illegal disclosure as well. That was a database that was illegally hacked, and the Ontario police still use that to punish him.
Yes, and that's one of the issues we've raised in the appeal. Is this permissible that police can use illegally obtained information? Another big one that we are now waiting for a decision on is the Tatlock case in British Columbia. So the Justice Center went to bat for thousands of doctors and nurses and other healthcare workers in British Columbia who were fired in 2021 for not taking the COVID vaccine, who would like to return to work. And despite severe understaffing in BC's healthcare system, these trained and qualified staff are still prevented from returning to work in 2023 by the BC government. There were not thousands of plaintiffs in the court action. So we've got, you know, a dozen or two dozen specific applicants in the court action, but the ruling is going to impact thousands of people. So I'm proud of our lawyers in BC for handling that. We are going to bat for Harvest Ministries International, which is a Christian charity, wanted to have a religious conference in Quebec. There's going to be lots of singing and praying and preaching, and it was a religious conference, and the Quebec government suddenly terminated the contract barely 6 weeks before, and they've, you know, promoted this conference, and people have probably bought plane tickets from other parts of Canada to go to the conference, and Quebec government pulled the plug because the Quebec government said, you know, these they've got anti-abortion views. Now, it just so happens the president or the leader said, or Lucier said, you know, yes, we are unapologetically pro-life, but it wasn't even a pro-life conference. But this is pretty scary, where government's going to say, you know, these are government facilities. I mean, if it was private, that would be a whole new ballgame. We would not be involved. Okay, if it's a private restaurant or hall or whatever and says, we don't want to rent to you, okay, whatever. But this is a government facility that is supposed to be available to everybody, regardless of your political views. So this is blatant, naked discrimination by the Quebec government, and we're holding them to account in this court action. We achieved a success in Saskatchewan with the parental consent policy, which requires schools to receive parents' consent before children under the age of 16 can embark on a transgender social transition by using opposite sex names and pronouns. So basically in Saskatchewan, if you're under 16, if you're a boy and you want to be called, you know, she and her and wear girls' clothing and use the girls' bathroom, you need parental consent for that. We can't do it behind parents' backs. So it was an LGBTQ group that took the Saskatchewan government to court, and we secured intervener status for two groups, Parents for Choice in Education, as well as the Gender Dysphoria Alliance. And the latter is a group of adults who have personal experience with gender transition and who have views about, you know, children should not be manipulated or pressured or encouraged to make these irreversible life-altering changes in as children. So in that court action, the success was that we secured the intervener status. How it then played itself out is that Saskatchewan used the notwithstanding clause to opt out of an interim court ruling that struck down the policy. And Saskatchewan government said, thank you, court, but no, we're going to keep the policy in force. And that was using Section 33 of the Charter.
That, I just want to point out, you raised a significant point a few shows ago, and I think it's worth stressing, you know, that the courts are given the right to strike down rights if, you know, if they're demonstrably justified. But governments are also given the ability to do it using the notwithstanding clause, and you drew an equivalency between the two, and I thought that was a good observation, worth repeating and remembering.
Yeah, there's some people that have this view that judges are all enlightened, and we need to be very reverent and deferential. Judges can do no wrong, and so therefore Section 33 is evil because it empowers politicians to pass legislation that says, notwithstanding the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, we are enacting as follows, blah, blah, blah. And so in Canada, you can pass a law that expressly says, regardless of Charter of Rights and Freedoms, we're passing this law. And then it does have to be renewed every 5 years, but it can be renewed indefinitely. Like in Quebec, they have in every 5 years, they renew some of their language laws there, which courts have said are an unjustified violation of free expression. So, you know, my view is neither group is infallible. Judges can make mistakes. The Supreme Court of Canada ruled that that women are not legally persons. That was overturned by the Privy Council because at that time the Supreme Court of Canada was not the highest court in the land, and so the Privy Council in Britain overturned the Supreme Court of Canada. So courts can make mistakes. And so can politicians. I don't think either group can be trusted 100% of the time. So we have a constitution that has some balance there. So if you don't like a law, you can go to court. And if you can persuade a judge to strike down the law is struck down. But then it's open to the legislature to say, okay, you know what? We're reenacting this law with Section 33. And so we're opting out of the court ruling. So there's supposed to be a dialogue back and forth between the judges and the politicians. And I think we'll see more of that over the years.
Good.
So we've gone to bat for Linda D'Armani in British Columbia. Her microphone was shut off by the Chilliwack School Board Chair, Willow Reichelt. I've seen YouTube video where she just routinely shuts off the microphones of people the moment they start to say something that she disagrees with. She declares it to be hateful or in violation of human rights policy or whatever. This is a serious problem. We've seen it in Ontario as well, where people get silenced on this false pretext that you're saying something hateful, you're violating human rights violations, so we're just shutting off your mic. So we can't stand for that, and so we're going to court there. The Ingram ruling that we've already talked about in Alberta, striking down the lockdown measures, and that ended the prosecutions against Pastor Tim Stevens and Pastor James Coates and Ty Northcott's No More Lockdowns Rodeo and a lot of other citizens. So that was good. We got the policy change in Alberta that the Public Health Act is going to be amended to provide democratic accountability. And we continue, and this court action is going to go on for a long time. We're defending Tamara Leach and Chris Barber and Freedom Convoy and a whole bunch of other people in a class action lawsuit that was launched by federal bureaucrat Zegzi Li and other downtown Ottawa residents. They are seeking $290 million in damages over losing some sleep due to horn honking. But in that claim, Zegzi Li is also seeking to hold Canadians liable for damages if they donated to Freedom Convoy. That's a very scary argument. So the Justice Center is going to bat for Canadians to have that privacy and confidentiality. That the state of the law currently is, you know, if you donate to a charity, maybe there's a downtown soup kitchen and they're doing great work, but they got a bad apple employee who does something bad. Okay. And so the soup kitchen gets sued over the misconduct of the employee. The way the law is right now, they fight it out in court and maybe the soup kitchen charity is found liable or maybe the claim is dismissed. But if you donated to the soup charity, even if they lose that court case, you're not liable as a donor to the soup charity. So Zegzi Li is naming as a class of defendants anybody who donated to Freedom Convoy. So the Justice Center is in court to stand up for the status quo on that particular point of law. We continue to try, thus far not successful, but to try to get Bonnie Henry on the stand. Seems the judges in BC do not want to see that happening. She granted special exemptions to permit Orthodox Jewish synagogues to hold in-person worship services while ignoring requests for accommodation from other faith groups. And I say kudos to the Orthodox Jews. You know, good for you. I'm happy you applied. I'm happy you got it. But this is fundamentally wrong when other faith groups were denied by Dr. Bonnie Henry to have indoor worship services, which the Orthodox Jews were allowed to have. So we are arguing abuse of process in ticket cases where there are pastors who, by the way, they objected to the total ban of worship services. Many, if not all of these pastors were willing to comply with the hand washing, social distancing, et cetera, et cetera. But Dr. Bonnie Henry, without any evidence that churches were worse spreaders than restaurants, she shut down the churches, but the restaurants could stay open. So we are, we're fighting that battle. We're taking Brian Peckford's case to the Supreme Court of Canada, appealing the dismissal for mootness, which was a horrible ruling that came out in October of 2022. We also lost in the Federal Court of Appeal. It should not be possible for governments to violate our rights and freedoms and then just drop the policy and then be able to wash their hands of it and say, oh, well, that was then, this is now, let's all forget about it. And courts should not be letting governments get away with that. Quebec trial, very interesting in September. Stéphanie Pépin and others gathered peacefully to demonstrate against Quebec's curfew, which, by the way, when the curfew was announced in Quebec, it was either the premier or the chief medical officer, when asked, is the curfew that, you know, you cannot go outside between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. Is that going to make a difference for COVID? Is that going to save lives? And they said, we don't know. So it's like, we're taking away your basic human right to walk outside of your house and we're going to confine you with a curfew. And so
that was to prevent nocturnal COVID, right?
Well, we all know that COVID's a lot more deadly at night, right? It gets really at 8 p.m.
COVID studies.
COVID outdoors gets really vicious at 8 o'clock. And then but 5 a.m., outdoor COVID gets really tame again, and you can safely go outside. Yeah. But our Quebec lawyer, Olivier Séguin, he actually cross-examined Horacio Arruda, the director of public health, as well as the former deputy minister of health, Richard Massé. And he obtained some quite extraordinary admissions. And so we await a ruling on the Quebec curfew case. We released two reports on digital ID, highlighting concerns about privacy, equality, and other charter rights and freedoms. And I just want to pause for a minute and say thank you to all the donors. You're making this possible. We've got the team of 9 lawyers and 5 paralegals, and we've got the communication staff, and they are working very hard every day. They're earning less money than what they could be elsewhere because they believe in the cause of truth and justice and freedom. And the only reason that we can do this work every day is because people are donating. And so we get $100 donations, $1,000 donations, $10,000 donations, $50 donations. They all add up. $100 by itself does not go very far. However, you get 5,000 people that donate $100 each. All of a sudden, you've got a half million, and that's enough money for two lawyers and a paralegal and a whole bunch of litigation expenses, right? So even $100 helps. So don't shy away. Visit our website before December 31st, www.jccf.ca, and you can donate online. If you want to mail in a check, our address is on the website. If your check is dated December 31st, even if we get it in the first day or two of January, that's fine. If the check is dated in December, then we're able to issue an official tax receipt. And so kudos to the donors. Give yourself a pat on the back. You're making all of this possible. So to wrap up, the charter curriculum for high school students, I've mentioned that. We had our annual Brandon Langelm Memorial Essay Contest. He was a staff lawyer who tragically passed away. And so we have named our annual essay contest in his honor. And we received 125 outstanding submissions, and prizes have been awarded. We have obtained the signatures of more than 20,000 Canadians on a petition calling upon the federal government to ban privacy-violating digital ID frameworks. We have a brochure that's excellent to raise public awareness. If you'd like copies, email info@jccf.ca, and we can send you 50 or 100 or 200, and they're good to hand out to people you know or just put them in mailboxes. And another highlight of the year was the George Jonas Freedom Award. The 2023 recipient was Jordan Peterson. We had a fantastic dinner in Toronto with, I think, close to 400 people there. And Dr. Jordan Peterson, like the other prior recipients, has made significant contributions to Canada as a free society. And so it's been, you know, it's been a tough and difficult year. You've heard the negative stuff at the beginning of the podcast, but we're doing a lot of good. We're going to keep on fighting. We're in this for the long game, and we're in the trenches. There are some civil liberties groups. They like to comment on cases. They like to write about court cases, and, you know, that's fine. That's useful. It needs to get done. The Justice Center does that as well. But we're in the trenches with a team of staff lawyers. We're in the trenches fighting these battles that sadly a lot of other civil liberties groups are, you know, they're not in the trenches nearly as often or as much. So I want to wish everybody a wonderful 2024. We're going to keep on fighting hard every day of 2024, fighting for your charter rights and freedoms. And happy new year. And I guess we'll record another podcast next year.
Right. Oh, yeah. Just to sum up, you win some, you lose some, but if you don't fight, you lose them all. So that's why we're here. Okay, John, a happy new year to you and to all our listeners. Thanks so much for participating in this year in review. We'll talk to you again real soon on the other side of the calendar. Okay. Ciao.